Hey everyone, welcome to Cloud Masters. I'm your host Matan Bordo, here with Sam Clark. And in our previous discussions with Ian Hart, we covered how cloud transforms financial governance and why tagging, finance-led tagging strategies kind of create the foundations for connecting cost to business outcomes. But today, we're going to take the final and slash next logical step in this mini FinOps series. We're going to explore unit economics in the cloud. So now that we understand kind of the cloud's consumption-based model and, you know, talking about cost allocation through tagging, we can finally get to answering the critical business questions. What does it actually cost to serve each customer or deliver each transaction? So I think it was even in the FinOps State of FinOps report, last one, 2025, while optimization remains a top priority for cloud spend, companies are increasingly shifting focus to quantifying business value and implementing unit economics. So Ian, we covered how cloud changes financial governance or how it has changed from like what it was before cloud. What does unit economics mean in a cloud environment, and why is it important for companies to understand?
Yeah, thanks. So we obviously covered previously why cost allocation is so important, and why representing cloud cost to business and to finance stakeholders in terms of what that cloud cost underpins and what, you know, what it supports, why that's so important, right? So that the business can understand exactly why they're spending that money. And we said that leads to things like stability and accountability and the capacity or the capability to plan or forecast. We kind of didn't really say why. But the other thing that allocations do, I mean, at any point in time, you know exactly how your cloud breaks down and what it supports. But allocations by themselves don't really account for dynamic change. So again, we've talked about how the cloud can change all by itself, right? So if it's got any form of auto scaling or any kind of capacity to respond to demand, then it's going to add cost all by itself. And so just knowing how at one point in time, what cost is supporting what business benefit doesn't take into account that dynamic change. So really, what do you do? You know, how does a business kind of start to understand why those things are changing or how they're changing? And really the way we need to try and understand this is in terms of what's demand or what is driving that demand. So what changes and causes the cloud to respond or causes the cloud to need to increase or decrease the number of resources that are supporting it? And if you can kind of quantify those demand drivers, if you can say, you know, if I have 12 of these things, I need this much cloud. But if I double it to 24 of these things, I need that much cloud. Then you've effectively got a way of understanding what will happen if you treble it, you know. And so effectively what we say is, you know, these are unit economics. And I think if you look at this from an AWS perspective, AWS always defined unit economics as being the amount you would need, the amount of cloud resources you would need to support an increase of whatever it is that you're counting. Generally speaking, you know, that's what we're talking about. So if I have anything that drives an increase or decrease in cloud technology, in number of resources, anything that causes a scaling up, you know, anything that causes me to deploy another pod or another instance or whatever it is because my auto-scaling group has fired above a certain amount, right? Whatever it is that's making that happen, then that's a demand driver. So if I can count those, if I understand what those are, particularly if I understand what those are from a business perspective, then I can effectively start saying, okay, I don't yet really understand from a business perspective why the cloud goes up and down. There's some clever things that IT is doing, right? But I know that it costs me about this much for that many, and it costs me about this much for that many. So I can pretty much, I can do the, logically, I can extend those numbers either way. And so this is it obviously becomes phenomenally useful. And gone are the days when you had a fixed budget. But those, unfortunately, if you're using the cloud, those days are gone. You can't have a fixed budget. So you need an alternative. You need something that's going to give you the same level of financial accountability without the fixed assuredness of an amount that you planned for and it isn't going to change. Now, obviously, finance teams are well versed in stuff changing, circumstances altering, things going up. So, I mean, they can deal with that, but they need a reason why, and they need something to justify it, and they need to be able to follow, and they need to be able to predict. And so unit economics effectively brings the reason to the fluctuation. It brings the underpinning explanation to why the cloud cost is so dynamic. And this is actually one of the really good reasons why we mentioned it in the last podcast, I think, why finance is very good at driving stability in costs. Because if you tell finance that their costs are going to go up because the cloud is required to support this business thingy, if the costs go up and you're not increasing the number of business thingies, then finance generally wants to know why. Now, this is a really good way of chasing teams to prevent things like cost anomalies or to jump on cost anomalies and to prevent things like accidental deployments or all the other kind of accidental type stuff. But this is fundamentally, I think, this is why unit economics are almost, a necessity. They're the next step on allocations, and that they provide you with that understanding as to why the cost changes, and ultimately the ability to predict on what you think might be a change.
I've used a chart in the past in some presentations showing the initial animation was showing cloud costs going up and also I think number of customers going up or something like that. Costs were just going up. And so finance was saying the hypothetical story I was pitching was finance says, we need to reduce cloud costs or put a cap on it. As you said in the previous episode, you've heard anecdotes, but then the animation, it shows the unit costs going down actually. And so is it necessarily a bad thing anymore that unit costs are going up if it's actually lately we've been driving more business relative to what we're spending to get it?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it is a bad thing if your unit costs are going up, but it's not a bad thing if your costs are going up. If your unit costs are staying the same or coming down, and actually what you're just doing is you're transacting more business. And as long as you're not making a loss, well, this is a good thing. And this is, unfortunately, the frustration you do often see is that there is a frustration with cloud costs going up, but there's not necessarily an understanding that actually you're making a profit on all this stuff. The business is doing well. Everybody needs to expend to spend money on cash to run their businesses. It's all about that profit and loss. It's all about that margin. And this is the trouble, fundamentally the trouble that unit economics starts to solve is that you can't draw that profit and loss line unless you know exactly what's driving that cost. And therefore, you've got your profit. You've effectively got you've got your built-in margin. If that makes sense.
And did we talk about in the last episode, is there a single metric unit that should every company have one? Do some of the customers you work with have more than one? Maybe you start with one if you don't have any already, but is there just a single golden metric that most companies chase, or do you have companies that have multiple?
I think you should absolutely have multiple. Effectively, right, you're never going to have an entire cloud platform that is driven entirely by a single thing, a single demand driver. It's very unusual. So ultimately, if you want to use unit economics to understand, I guess from a finance perspective, right, if you want to know, to understand unit economics from the point of view of how you make revenue, so what drives revenue. Now, if that's a single thing, then it kind of makes sense, right? Because if you're looking to understand what it costs you to make that revenue, and therefore what your revenue gap is and what your profit or loss margins are, then that makes sense, right? If you're using unit economics to understand the profitability or not, or just the efficiency of an individual system, then it totally makes sense to have a unit economic on that system. So for instance, if you know that you've got you might have some sort of cluster that's receiving a bunch of requests and you monitor the number of requests, And because you know that the more requests, the bigger your cluster has to be, right? Now, if you know that, there's a unit economic, right? So I've got the size of more the cost of my cluster, whatever it is, and I've got the number of requests. Now I can work then on the efficiency of that cluster, because if I make certain changes, that means actually I can reduce the size of my cluster. So therefore, the cost of each transaction goes down, then my efficiency has gone up. That doesn't necessarily translate, for instance, into revenue or cost of goods sold or anything like that, because it's part of a big chain. But I can, you know, it's very pertinent to things like efficiency of individual systems. So you really need a unit economic that has the boundary of the resources that support that particular demand driver.
So like if you're an Uber, you probably have a cost, a unit economics for Uber Eats, Uber Black, Uber X,
yeah,
Uber
yeah,
Helicopter.
And I Sam's going to smile now because I have my favorite example or analogy, which is I use this to teach unit economics in the past. But it's a kind of an indication of why you might necessarily not just need a single unit economic, even for a single kind of a group of resources. So let's say you have two aircraft, right? And you have one old one and one new one. And there's, 30 years difference in technology between the two. And if I take one off and fly it across the Atlantic, it costs me X amount. If I take the second one off and fly it across the Atlantic, it costs me Y. So I've got two aircraft and I've got a cost per mile. Very clear cost per mile. So I might have the new aircraft has a much, much lower cost per mile. And that's great, right? So that new aircraft is clearly better in every way, okay? Now, if I've only got one unit economic, that's what I'm working on, because this one has a way lower cost per mile. It might be that particular one is a nice aircraft, but relatively small cabin, right? And the reason why it's got such a good cost per mile is because it's lighter or it has fewer people on it. So I probably need to think about the same thing. I need to think about cost per passenger. So if I've got three times the number of passengers on the old aircraft, then it's three times more efficient in terms of my costs, right? Because I've got three times more passengers. So a unit economic is great because it provides you with that kind of efficiency within the boundary of the resources that support it as a demand driver. But it's not the only picture. And it was really interesting because I used this example in I was with a room full of CFOs and finance people. And I was, droning on about FinOps and what, cost buckets, and they were all sort of dozing off. But when I started to use that example, they started to argue about which was the most useful, whether it was cost per passenger or cost per mile, and how would you factor in, well, what about things like the length of the runway? That would surely cost in, in fact, and all of it, they were basically talking in business terms. They'd switched to something which they understood and which was functional, and they were all very intelligent people, and they were digging into the details. They didn't for a second consider anything that was driving those details. So they didn't think of, the fact that we were talking about material science in between the two aircraft, and engine design, or fuel efficiency, and maybe friction of the paint, I don't know, all these different things. They didn't care because it doesn't matter to them. And they don't need to get involved in that. What they did care was this one was X per mile, that one was Y per mile, this one was X per passenger. How else can we measure these things? How else can we think about it? And this was obviously, this is extremely efficient FinOps, because, as a business response, if you'd said, actually, is there any way we can get this one like 3% cheaper? Because if we can, blah, blah. And okay, that's for the techie team to go back and say, well, maybe we can shave a bit more weight off. In IT terms, maybe we can, do something that's a little bit more efficient or better data or something, right? Do something that drives a tiny bit more efficiency. Now that is, in a sense, that's like the unit economics and FinOps working at a peak efficiency, right? Because it's IT action being driven by business demand or business requirements, and businesses getting all the information they need and no more, because they don't care about the engine design, or they don't really care about the, the superstructure, whatever the hell is made of. They don't care about any of that stuff. They just care about what they care about, right? And they're getting all that information through the FinOps process. Not sure that answered your question.
I think it does, but if I can bring it back around there, I think what it really highlights is, yes, you do need to have multiple unit economics and multiple KPIs within any given system, But the KPIs that matter, or the unit economics in this case, that matter to the senior management are not going to be the same ones that manage it, that matter to the engineers. Using the example of the aeroplanes, some engineer might find out that a particular brand of paint is lighter than another one and therefore shaves off some weight of the plane and therefore makes it more fuel efficient. Or that you mentioned the tires, right? Maybe landing on a certain runway is rougher and causes the tires to disintegrate faster, or a different brand of tire lasts longer and it needs less maintenance. Whatever those things are, those types of engineering decisions come to a final KPI overall of lower cost per passenger, right? Or more fuel efficient, lower cost per mile as well. But the engineers here are looking at what's the cost of that particular component, the weight of the fuselage or something like that. And so when you're looking at that in an IT system, it might be, you're looking at how many transactions a database can handle in an hour or a cluster, as you mentioned earlier. The managers probably don't really care about that. Those people at the senior end of your business probably don't care. But when you can bring that back to a cost per customer transaction or a cost per cluster per day or whatever that might be, whatever metric makes sense for you, then that's where you start seeing those results of the business driving it. And if everyone's working on the bits they need to, me as a database engineer, I'm working on making my database more efficient, that brings down the overall cost. And then that means that the people doing the customer management system make less costly database calls. And then that brings down the overall cost and so on and so on and so on. Then you get to the point where FinOps is really driving those business decisions.
There's that FinOps principle that everyone owns their costs. Maybe they rephrased it since, but that's the principle generally. And it kind of starts with awareness. Engineers being aware of what costs that they're responsible for. Maybe it's a dashboard, it's something scheduled to their Slack or something like that. It's you have an optimization opportunity. It's turned into a Jira task. But it flows, and then having that visibility, then eventually, if not immediately, but it eventually prompts you to ask yourself questions. Oh, why are costs like that, et cetera? And so I also think what I'm getting at is that you have this like high level unit economics from the business side of things. Like, hey, we have this cost per customer, we have cost per mile, whatever. How can we bring that down? And then the engineers start thinking, what are the things from our side that contribute to that? How can we measure that? Once we measure it, how can we bring that down? It kind of like, but that's kind of what you were saying in these past episodes about it being driven from the top, and then engineers work from that business side directive.
No, absolutely. I think if you kind of adjust the scale as you go out, obviously IT decisions need to be made technical decisions need to be made by those people who understand the technology and the implications and a bunch of other things. But business decisions are made by those whose job it is to make business decisions. And ultimately, really, what happens in IT should be driven as a business decision, because it has a cost, it has an implication, and it has an impact on the cost of goods sold, and it has an impact on your revenue. You just obviously, you're not going to spend, or you're not going to put, maybe you just take IT and put them in charge of the business. That's one way, because they could probably understand a lot, but no one has the time to do all of that lot. You need a translation mechanism. And I think this is where, FinOps fits the gap in terms of feeding the right information with the right level of translation and the right representation. That's how FinOps does. It takes the technical data and kind of strips of the stuff that it just doesn't need to, you don't need to know. It's not, it's erroneous. It's just going to get in the way. But it represents things as what is meaningful to the business. And the business says, okay, well, we need to do this or we don't need to do this. In some ways, this is because, in doing so allows you in some ways to defend some IT decisions. When I say that, for example, I was talking to a customer recently, and it was about FinOps, but it was also about their DR strategy. And I kind of pointed out, well, DR is a business benefit, isn't it? It's not something you do for fun. You do it because you want increased uptime, or you want reduced downtime if there's a big issue, or depending on, what is your level of requirement? Because the business will probably say whatever the business says, we can tolerate this or we can't tolerate that. And so you have an IT response, right? You have an IT kind of a mechanism to avoid that downtime or to speed that recovery. But that has a cost. Now, if you represent that cost in terms of unit economics, and that cost, because it's a scalable cost, because it's DR, as you scale, your DR site potentially needs to scale, then it's a cost per, right? So it's a cost per or whatever your demand driver is. And you can represent that as a cost per, because as it grows, it grows. If it's a single, if it's a single action, it's a single thing you're doing, then it doesn't represent cost per. I mean, there's a bump to begin with, but then it kind of stays the same. So it's very important to understand what is within your, the kind of purview of being driven by the demand, and not kind of mix that up a bit and not get it too kind of confused. So I think that, but if you do, if it is demand driven by the demand, it's a very good way of representing to the business why there is this extra cost, and actually putting it in the terms of the business benefit it's delivering. An additional stability, an additional uptime or availability, or reduced downtime in the case of an incident is very much a business benefit. You only do it because it's a business benefit, and it should be reflected as such.
It's like paying for insurance, no?
Well, yeah, right.
On that note, do you, like, I'm wondering in both cases, so before you even go in and explain, use your airplanes analogy and it clicks for them, and even afterwards, what are the mistakes maybe you see companies making when they're going into making, to setting their unit economics for the first time? Does it differ? Like, is it like before the, before you explain it, before they understand it better, the mistakes are more egregious, and then the mistakes after are different, like, or is it kind of all in the same, the mistakes you see them make?
So I think, you tend, obviously we're limited to the number of people we interact with, the number of customers we deal with. And I think from my perspective, it's people come to unit economics when they've got a reasonable handle on things like allocation, cost buckets, and representing cost and explaining cost. So they, it's, you know, you often go through that process first. I think there's a general fear of dealing with unit economics. I think, I don't know why, it's perceived as hard. And I think that process of is potentially because it's done by IT. And it comes back, I mean, we've said this a million times, it comes back to FinOps being a collaboration between multiple teams. But it's a little bit like a, you know, your tagging strategy. If IT says we're going to do this, we're going to tag, this is how we're going to tag, without asking the questions of who needs to know, you know, who needs to use tagging to explain costs, and what do they want to know? That's where you start with a tagging strategy, not saying, okay, we're going to have 3 for security, 4 for automation, 2 for, you know, whatever it is. And I think it's the same thing. So if unit economics is effectively done by IT, they generally start with how many transactions can I take? You know, how many what's my cost per transaction on this cluster?
Yeah, there was a customer who used who basically is calculating unit economics using, you know, our product, Duet Cloud Intelligence. And their metric that they're looking at is, I think, cost per million API calls or 1,000 API calls or something like that. And I was thinking of that just as we were talking earlier about the airplane analogy, and just wondering, did finance have an input into that? Or
And actually, that's a great unit economic, you know, because what that will do is it'll help you drive efficiency, and it'll help you monitor for things like unusual cost or whatever. But yeah, it doesn't help the business. It doesn't do anything for the business.
Unless your business is pricing based on the number of API calls.
Which they
might. I actually don't remember that. So maybe, you know.
This is the thing about, I think, any KPI and any unit economic, maybe it works for you, maybe it doesn't. Right? And I think the biggest mistake that I see most people make is trying to replicate the thing that the other guy did, right? It's, I mean, it's a totally different analogy, but when I joined AWS, we used to do quarterly business reviews with customers, and someone gave me a slide deck and said, deliver that to your customer. And it obviously, you know, update the numbers and make it suit your customer, but it didn't tell a story, and it didn't actually relate in any way to my customer's strategic objectives. It was not a business review. It was, here's a look at some metrics that may be interesting to you or not. And if you're doing that with KPIs, if you're doing that with, in particular, unit economics, they might work or they might not. If your customer, like taking that example, if they're building a product that is charged on how many API calls you make, then yeah, absolutely. Bring those costs down means more profitability. Maybe it's helping to drive the overall cost down by focusing on that. But people try to, firstly, focus on the wrong economics, and secondly, focus on too many. In my experience. and they try to boil the ocean instead of just doing a maybe a manageable number of unit economics to get started. Those are the two biggest mistakes I see.
I can see why it can be intimidating unit economics, but it's like the solution to making the cloud less or more predictable for yeah. finance. I don't know if it's confusing only if that point doesn't hit it for them, but it makes it easier to make decisions.
I think one of the things that drives the fear factor and how complex it is people think it needs to be perfect. People think it needs to be 100% automated based on instrumentation coming out of your code and all these sorts of things, when sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes there's an example that Ian uses in one of his training courses of, you know, how many users we've got a month and how much money we made in a month. You don't have to go down to every last second of every transaction. If you've got at least a basic number and you can divide it by the cost by the number of users, then you've got a unit economic, and that's a place to get started. And if you can, over time, bring the cost to serve those customers down, you're making more profit. Yes, we can get more detailed and we can get down to per transaction and per minute and so on. But if you start with a manageable workflow, while you're waiting on doing extra instrumentation in your code and all those other things, then you can at least start getting an overview and seeing where you need to focus.
It's like getting in shape, you know, just start going to the gym. Even if you don't know what you're doing, pick a machine. Maybe don't put too much weight.
Yeah, but Sam's right. Ultimately, how much money does the entire company spend on cloud? And how much money does the entire company make in revenue? That's your first unit economic, right? Because the cloud costs you this much per revenue. And I think that is genuinely a viable unit economic depending on the size of your organization. But it is tricky. It is potentially tricky. I mentioned this earlier when I was talking about, the R considerations. But if you have something which is a single cost, doesn't scale with your demand driver, then, you know, should that be inside your specific unit economic, or it certainly should be inside a general, because that is all costs. But that kind of defining what actually supports a demand driver, that could take a little bit of a challenge. And translating business benefits into demand drivers. But these things aren't this, they also, it sounds difficult, but they're genuinely, it's not that hard. I mean, it doesn't have to be revenue based either. It doesn't have to be sort of, you know, the other example I use all the time is number of developers. And developers, you have more developers than they're developing more, right? So you've got potentially shorter time to market, or you've got more features coming out, or you've got more people doing this stuff, trialing it. You've got more ideas, you've got more testing, you've got all that kind of stuff, right? So people pay for developers because it's a business benefit. And so more developers is more of a benefit. It's probably a topping out point there. But a developer costs a lot of money. A developer person, you know, they obviously there's the wages and where they work and their workstation, but they presumably got some sort of sandpit environment, and they presumably got a bunch of resources that they use and a bunch of other things, right? So how much does all that cost divided by the number of developers? And can you, there you are, there's your real cost per developer. That's a pretty useful unit economic, because you can certainly work on that in terms of efficiency. And obviously, devs actually factor in to the whole value chain, don't they? The whole cost chain, I should say, rather, because they're part of the cost to develop the next generation of the feature that's earning you money. So they have to be included in your entire cost per good sold. But you can, therefore, you can certainly focus in on the efficiencies of those. And a simple cost of all the development environments per number of developers is a perfectly good unit economic. So it doesn't have to be. Most technical ones are probably not revenue generated, because they are, you know, right down to the actual technical demand. But it is, I think, as Sam says, it doesn't have to be perfect, but it is an iterative process where, you know, you can start from the small technical ones and work up, but also start from the potentially more broad business demand drivers and kind of work downwards.
I think. Out of the three episodes, this is one where I learned a lot, but this is also like a very advanced topic. So I don't.
It's an easy topic. Stop telling people it's hard.
Sorry. It's just, you know, you need some building blocks leading up to it, right?
You do. You definitely need tags.
You need to understand. You need to not treat cloud like it's on premises. And you need to, you know, probably allocate costs and not, or at least have very little unallocated costs.
The truth is that all of the other things that we've talked about in the previous two episodes are building blocks towards getting better unit economics, better cost of goods sold. And if you treat them in the same way as Ian just said, if you make it an iterative process and you keep building on it, then you get better tag coverage, which leads to better ability to account for costs, which leads to better cost of goods sold, right? It's getting more accurate without necessarily improving the overall situation. You're getting more information about what you're doing. And I don't think I've ever heard anybody in business or finance say more information would be a bad thing. You know, if they've got more information to make a decision, if they've got more information to manage their budget, it's usually, and I mean information, not data here, actual actionable information does help.
Yeah. People. I've only heard that in the context of logging. You don't need to log everything, but
no, that's data. That's not information.
Okay. any final thoughts or questions? That's about it from me on my end.
Yeah, I think key. We mentioned this kind of the end of the last podcast, and it's what does everybody need to know? I think IT people, technical people, understand this FinOps thing, and there's a business thing. But I quite often meet finance teams, and when I do get the chance to meet CFOs, I do, and it's a relative rarity that they understand what unit economics represents. But it's very, very common that they express the challenges of not having unit economics. So I think that one of the reasons why I focus quite a lot on FinOps for finance and FinOps for business teams is that there is, I think, a general, it's much less likely you're going to find someone who understands FinOps and unit economics within finance and business teams than within technical teams. So this is the area where these are the people who potentially suffer the most because they don't have predictable costs, because they can't forecast, and they have to make business decisions based on data which they're not sure about, or which they don't know why it's being affected, or why it's being impacted, or why it's fluctuating, or why it's so dynamic. And that's a very difficult business. If you're in a competitive industry, you need to really know about these things. So arguably, they're the most affected, the worst affected. And so I think this is really why the concepts, the principles of unit economics, without the how the airplane is made, without any of that stuff, is a really key thing to get across. And that conversation is one that needs to be started. There are lots of ways it can go. There are lots of, priorities. There are lots of different things and impacts that it can have. But that's the conversation that needs to be started.
And with that, I think we even use that line for if we ever make a sizzle reel out of the series, so we could just use that as like the preview. But thanks for joining us again, Ian, and Sam, you too, I guess. And thanks for listening, whoever's listening. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you in the next episode. Whatever the topic may be, maybe it'll be FinOps, maybe it'll be something else. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
I wanted to throw in a jab there.